Brian Lehrer on WNYC with more now on the aftermath of the Tucson massacre, including the relevance of the tone of political discourse in this country today. And now you can call in directly on this. This, of course, has been the topic of much of the political discourse online and elsewhere, including on our site, itsafreecountry.org, our new political website. We have a poll question up there with respect to the Sarah Palin crosshairs map and whether that's relevant at all, if not to this shooting, directly to the kind of atmosphere that could set off a person like Jared Laughlin. So you can go register your response to that poll question at itsafreecountry.org. And again, here is Congresswoman Giffords on MSNBC in March 2010 reacting to that map. The 2010 midterm election campaign included a map, if you're not familiar with this, with crosshairs, as if in the sights of a gun, over Giffords' district, along with the districts of 19 other Democratic lawmakers who voted for the health care bill. This was posted by Sarah Palin. And after posting the map on her Facebook page, Palin told her Twitter followers to go there with the message, "Don't retreat, instead reload." And Giffords reacted at the time on MSNBC.
I think it's important for all leaders, not just leaders of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. There's certainly a lot of independents out there that they may not even resonate towards. But community leaders, figures in our community to say, look, this, we can't stand for this. I mean, this is a situation where they really, really need to realize that the rhetoric and firing people up and, you know, even things, for example, we're on Sarah Palin's targeted list. But the thing is that the way that she has it depicted has the crosshairs of a gun site over our district. And when people do that, they've got to realize there's consequences to that action.
So that was Congresswoman Giffords herself back on March 25th of last year. And then on Saturday night, the sheriff who's in charge of investigating, now everybody's in charge, the FBI's gotten into it, Homeland Security is getting into it, but the sheriff who technically is in charge of the investigation of the shooting in Tucson, Pima County Sheriff Clarence Dubnik, also raised this issue. Let's listen to 50 seconds, an extended excerpt of what Sheriff Dubnik said.
And today, I want to tell you, I hope that all Americans are saddened and as shocked as we are. And I hope that some of them, or most of them, are as angry as I am and as a lot of us are. And I think it's time as a country that we need to do a little soul searching. Because I think it's the vitriolic rhetoric that we hear day in and day out from people in the radio business and some people in the TV business and what we see on TV and how our youngsters are being raised, that this has not become the nice United States of America that most of us grew up in. And I think it's time that we do the soul searching.
Sheriff Clarence Dubnik on Saturday evening in Tucson. And listeners, you can weigh in. And we know people are on all sides of this, and we have various blog posts on itsafreecountry.org, some of them saying it's ridiculous, get over this, blaming Sarah Palin. This guy had nothing to do with Sarah Palin. There's no evidence that he was aware of this map or the Tea Party, that this map is really just obviously a, you know, in the context of peaceful electoral politics. So, as I say, opinions are all over the map on this, the map of any kind, and you can go and weigh in either online or now on the phone. Go to itsafreecountry.org. You can read the various posts that we have and post your own response and respond to our poll question on this, or call us up 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. This gets into Sharon Engel, who was the U.S. Senate candidate running against Harry Reid for the Republicans, who once referred to Second Amendment methods of resisting encroaching big government and things like that. So with us now is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. He posted a piece yesterday on The Atlantic and National Journal sites called The Cloudy Logic of Political Shootings. And hi, James. So nice of you to come on today.
Hello,
welcome
Brian,
back
nice to
WNYC.
Yes, thank you.
Why cloudy logic?
Just because my argument was that whenever a political leader is attacked or killed, by definition, this is political in some sense. That's why we use the term assassination rather than just murder or killing. But often the passions that drove an individual killer are hard to connect to the reasons that made a political leader prominent. I think that on the one hand, we would have the pure case of, say, John Wilkes Booth, who killed Abraham Lincoln because of the Civil War. But we had, you know, the shooting of Ronald Reagan by John Hinckley was about Jodie Foster, and when Squeaky Fromm tried to kill Gerald Ford, that was from some Manson family after effect. And if you take the two Kennedy family assassinations of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, in each case, Lee Harvey Oswald, to the extent we can tell, he, you know, as a Cuba sympathizer himself, he thought Kennedy was too anti-communist, whereas the main atmosphere against Kennedy at that time was that he was too leftist, et cetera. And Sirhan Sirhan's attack on Robert F. Kennedy, to the extent it was rational in any sense, was about Palestinian politics, which was not the main issue in Robert Kennedy's time there. So my point is that there are political passions, but it's often very difficult to trace them to the motives of the person who actually pulled the trigger.
How do you see Jared Laughlin in this context from what we know?
I obviously present myself as no expert on him. The evidence that seems to appear is like John Hinckley or like Arthur Bremer, who tried to kill George Wallace, in that he seems to be a mentally disturbed person, to put it mildly. But the further point I tried to make is that there are some of these attacks which seem to come entirely from nowhere, as in the case of Lynette Fromm, who tried to kill Gerald Ford. And there are also attacks that seem to come from where it's legitimate to ask about the larger political climate. For example, when John Kennedy was killed in Dallas, there were decades worth of examinations of whether the hate climate in Dallas at that time had anything to do with his killing. And I think the fact that there has been so much violent rhetoric in the last couple of years and martial imagery, it's legitimate to ask whether that is connected with this phenomenon in general, even if the person himself was mainly deranged.
And somehow Jared Laughlin's insanity, again from what we know based on press accounts, did seem to get hooked up with paranoia with respect to the government. And not only that, he also, you know, was angry at his math teacher for teaching fake math or whatever that was that he said in class. He had rants about grammar on his websites, but he did get involved with some amount of anti-government paranoia. And I guess that raises the question of whether a Sarah Palin or anybody else has the responsibility to assume that there will be some wackos out there who are just mentally unstable or unhinged or whatever word you want to use, who are going to be more susceptible to, you know, rhetoric that's over the top, even if the politician means it with a wink or means it only to be addressed to rational political actors who are only going to act at the ballot box and on demonstration lines and things like that.
Yes, and let me say two things about that. One is to use an analogy I didn't use on the Atlantic site, and I'll try to present as carefully as I can. Whenever there is an attack and that we would define as terrorism over the last decade or so by some crazy person or deranged person, but who is associating himself or herself with an Islamic cause, there is great expectation from the world in general that so-called responsible or moderate Islamic leaders will condemn this and say that it's not an appropriate reflection of what Islam stands for, et cetera. I think so, too, it's important in moments like this for people who whose past imagery might or might not have encouraged somebody who starts out being deranged to take the lead in saying, let's calm down the rhetoric, let's find ways to discuss our disagreements in civil fashion, let's be sure to condemn any excess of this sort. And so whether or not one can argue that anybody's positioning is responsible looking backward for a deranged person's violent action, I think there's also a sort of positive responsibility on everybody's behalf now to say, this is not what we mean, this is not what we want, let's find ways to talk civilly about matters where we disagree.
On the other hand, you don't want to tamp down political speech too much. You want snarky political speech in the United States. You want sarcastic political speech in the United States. You want pointed and angry political speech in the United States, because it's not a game. It's about people's lives. And so I wonder how you feel, for example, about the distinction that Paul Krugman made in his New York Times column today. He drew the line at what he called eliminationist rhetoric. He used that word. I don't know if you read it. He said
yes.
There is eliminationist rhetoric, which I guess, implies the taking of violent action against people.
Right. And I think, excuse me, just to extend what I was, to connect that to what I was saying before,
sure,
about the looking backwards versus looking forward. It is just inarguably true that a lot of Sarah Palin's campaign imagery has featured her role as a hunter. There was the famous ad with these gun sites, which tried to be presented as surveyor sites on various congressional districts, including Representative Giffords in Arizona. And so whether or not that had anything at all to do with this this violent and disturbed young man in Arizona, I think that this is where looking forward, she and others and all sides can say, of course, we don't want to say that anybody needs to be eliminated from political discussion. And to the extent we have gone too far in talking about the Tree of Liberty being refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants, to the extent we've used too many ammunition and guns and ammo type images, mm-hmm, let's find ways to avoid that tone and talk about our disagreements.
You used the word terrorism before, and I want to take a call on that. Jay in Bergen County, this came up earlier in the show, too, whether terrorism is an appropriate word to apply to this act on Saturday. Jay, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, good morning, Brian. I want to say that the fact that the shooter's Caucasian is the reason that no one's using that word terrorism. If the guy was Muslim, everybody would be using that statement. And the fact that he didn't just shoot the congresswoman herself, he shot other people, it was an act of terrorism. You know, it would have been an assassination if he shot her and left, you know, but the fact that he wounded other people, you know, the guy was, you know, trying to make a statement, I think.
Have you thought about that, James Fallows?
Yes, I have. And it is worth thinking about if this had been an Islamic person, let's say somebody who had gotten in from Yemen or someplace, who had been caught doing this, you know that we'd be back to the color code terror rating, and there'd be lockdowns every place, and et cetera, et cetera. And so it is, yes, and I think that this has us reflect both on the way we use terrorist rhetoric in general and what we think, the way we think about this incident. So I think it's a sign of the ways in which we have had excessive and contorted reactions to the label of terrorism versus violence. And so I basically agree.
And yet the impact could be the same, right? If it is now harder to have an open political meeting with an elected member of Congress in our democracy, we're a little bit less of a free country as a result. We're a little bit less of a free society as a result. And certainly people will experience fear, if not outright terror, at the prospect of going to such a meeting and meeting with elected officials.
Yes, I agree. And that's why I think the proper response from the citizenry to this episode, in addition to everything else we do about political rhetoric and about gun laws and about mental health and all the rest, is to reassert our ability to live and act as free and non-fearful people. I think that's the proper response to terrorism as we usually think about it. And I think there's been too much sort of fearful response over the last decade. But I think also, too, that there's been a movement among a number of Congress people saying it's all the more important next weekend that they all have meetings with their constituents and they show that they're not paralyzed by this fear and that we won't let the ramifications of this horrible event be all the more magnified by crimping our ability to be to work as a democracy.
And hopefully many of us in the public will attend those meetings, even if we never have before. I think
yes.
of this 9-year-old girl who was killed at the event on Tucson. In Tucson, she had been getting interested in politics, and apparently a friend of the family took her to this to get a first sort of close-up look at how politics works. And, of course, the result was tragedy. So maybe we'll see a lot more 9-year-olds out there with their parents or others as a show of solidarity as well next week. Roy in Riverdale, you're on WNYC. Roy, thanks a lot for calling.
Good morning, Brian. I'm first time calling your show. I appreciate all the information and the people you have. I think that the target thing about Sarah Palin is absurd because you can blame the store target. Maybe he drove by and gave him an idea. And the second point I wanted to make, since you have Carolyn Maloney there, all these politicians.
We had Carolyn, just to be accurate, we had Carolyn McCarthy.
McCarthy,
Congresswoman
sorry.
From Long Island, yeah.
My mistake, Carolyn McCarthy. You have all these politicians, especially in the New York area, saying that they're going to meet their constituents. I think a lot of people in this state agree with the statement I'm going to make, that most of these politicians do not meet with people they disagree with, as opposed to this very honorable congresswoman in Arizona. So next time you have a guest who's a senator, politician, congressman, whoever, tell them to make a special meeting for people they don't agree with.
Roy, thank you very much. James Fallows, I think it's a good point, and it was especially honorable the way Congresswoman Giffords had these what she calls Congress on your corner meetings, where literally anybody could come and line up and express their opinions or their grievances or their requests. Do you think that is rare?
I think it actually is more common than your caller might suggest. I don't know how much time your caller has spent going around with politicians. Over my life as a reporter, I've done a lot of it. And the one thing that makes politicians different from most of the rest of us is, in fact, they have to expose themselves all the time to people who come up and they have either sort of low-level grievance X, Y, or Z, the potholes aren't fixed, the Social Security check isn't fixed, or much higher-level complaints about the vote they cast on this issue or that issue. So I think it actually is more common than you would think for public officials, especially at the congressional level or below at state levels, to have this this direct retail experience with people who don't agree with them. And that makes them that's a very important part of the job. And I think there's more of it than you might assume.
Chaim in Washington Heights. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. First time caller, as they say. Now, I actually am an Orthodox Jew, and what this is reminding me of, particularly the rhetoric leading up to this, is reminding me of a lot of the stuff that was happening just after Oslo and leading up into the Rabin assassination and many of the modern Orthodox yeshivas in Israel. And basically, what reminds me of it is a sort of plausible deniability kind of rhetoric where people are not exactly saying these very, very radical conservative things. And to a large extent, you hear people talking about the dog whistle effect that Sarah Palin's rhetoric has, the idea of Glenn Beck's constantly saying he's just asking questions, which is exactly what was happening when people were asking the question of whether Yitzhak Rabin had the status of somebody who was being somebody who's chasing after you with intent to kill, whether he had the status of you being allowed to kill him in self-defense. And for all the months leading up to it, this was sort of building up more and more until there was somebody who took it a little bit too seriously and actually did something about it. And thank you very much.
Chaim, thank you very much. Do you want to react to that, James Fallows?
Yes, I would say I basically agree with that. And that's a clearer way of what I was saying earlier on. There are times, if we assume that most people who are assassins are deranged in some way, there are times when this seems entirely disconnected from the surrounding political mood, and there are times when it does not seem entirely disconnected. And I think the Rabin assassination is certainly one case of that. Gandhi's killing in India is another. The Kennedy assassination, John Kennedy assassination, I think this, in this case too, it at least is legitimate to look at the possible connection between surrounding political rhetoric and the act of a deranged and violent person.
And how far would you go with respect to what words you would put into that category? I don't know if you saw the exchange on Fox News Sunday yesterday between NPR's Mara Liasson and Britt Hume from Fox over the word socialism. Mara was saying, well, when you get these words that imply the necessity for the country to militarily respond to defend our freedom, like tyranny, which has been used frequently with respect to the health care law, fascism, Nazism, socialism, and Britt Hume said, well, I agree with you about everything except socialism, that's not in the same category. And, of course, we hear that so much. So it was just an interesting moment to me that they kind of agreed that – they kind of agreed – well, first of all, I was even surprised to hear them agree that tyranny might be beyond the pale.
Yep.
With respect to describing the health care law. I don't know if pressed he would actually agree with ruling that out. But Mara's category was words that could be – interpreted as something that the United States needs to defend itself against militarily, such as communism was. And there they went around and round a little bit on socialism. Did you happen to see that?
I didn't see that. If I had seen it, I would have miraculously agreed with Britt Hume and saying that I think that socialism, you know, many of America's allies in Europe are socialist economies. And so I think that's not by definition a fighting word as many of the rest of these are. And I think probably the purest example of fighting words were Sharon Angle, the Nevada candidate's description of that there need to be Second Amendment remedies, i.e. gun rights if there are political disagreements. So I think that if there is a benefit of this episode, it may be to delegitimize that kind of talk anymore and have talk about the actual disagreements. And socialism to me is a disagreement about economic policy as opposed to the basic legitimacy of a position.
And another example that Jonathan Alter brought up here last hour, there is that talk show host in Florida, Joyce Kaufman, who talked about, well, if ballots don't work, try bullets. And then she was going to be the chief of staff or a top aide to one of the newly elected Republican congressmen from Florida, but then was deemed politically unacceptable for something else that she said. But there, apparently, that was spoken on talk radio, local talk radio in Florida. I see that Congressman Elliot Engel is calling in. Congressman Engel, a Democrat from the Bronx and into the northern suburbs of New York City. Congressman, you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thanks a lot for calling.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, Congressman, let me ask you something about the schedule this week. I understand that Congress has canceled its votes for the whole week or all its business, including the health reform repeal vote. Tell us what's going on, and do you see this as respectful of the victims or political on the part of the Republicans to not have the health reform repeal either associated with or covered by the news of this, or simply out of security concerns?
I think it's a little of everything. I think it's mostly respect. We had a conference call yesterday with all the Democratic and Republican members. First time in my 22 years in Congress that we've had a joint a conference call. Speaker John Boehner was very gracious, spoke very well, as did Nancy Pelosi. I think it's out of respect than anything else. Obviously, health care repeal, which I strongly oppose, is a very contentious subject and probably would have come down to almost a party-line vote with all Republicans voting yes and almost all Democrats voting no. And I think that combined in a debate like that, you have a heightened rhetoric, and I think combine that with just the general climate, I think everyone thought it was better out of respect to postpone it. So what we have this week is instead of doing, we were going to have 7 hours of debate on it. It would have started Tuesday night. The vote would have been Wednesday. There'll be no recorded votes on Tuesday whatsoever, just a pro forma session. And then on Wednesday, there'll be a resolution honoring our dear colleague, Gabby Giffords, and the other people who were killed and wounded in Tucson. And there will probably be one vote on that resolution on Wednesday. And then the following week, we are scheduled to have President Obama's State of the Union Tuesday night. I don't know if that will still happen. The Republicans, at the end of this week, were doing their conclave, as is done every January, their retreat. And I think that probably will go on. I haven't heard anything differently. I'm obviously not a Republican, so I don't know, I'm privy to what they're doing. But I would assume they would continue their retreat. And we have our Democratic retreat the following week, on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. So I don't know what the schedule right now. It hasn't been decided for next week, but I would imagine the president will go on with the State of the Union, and we have some kind of modified votes next week. I don't think that we would have the health care repeal debate next week. I think they'll let it rest for a while.
Congressman Engel, do you think that this event changes our country in any significant way? Or is this an isolated, horrifying event, and we pick up the pieces and move on pretty much the way we were?
Well, I think it does change our country. I think it's, again, a little bit of both. It changes our country because this is not only an attack on one congresswoman. This is really an attack on American democracy. You know, we conduct our politics and our governance by ballots, not bullets. And this was an attempt in this deranged person's mind. The rumors are that he hates the government and targeted his congresswoman. She had seen him before when she had these outdoor town hall meetings, and even sent him a letter thanking him for coming to previous meeting.
On the other hand, it's so cloudy, to use the word of our other guest, James Fallows, as to whether he had any political motivations at all, cloudy at best. How far do you want to go down that road?
Well, I think what it does point to is that members of Congress or any public person is somewhat vulnerable. If anybody wants to do any of us any harm, it's virtually impossible to stop them. We all know it in the back of our minds. This brings it out. This heightens it. But we all know it. I mean, at the same time that Gabby was doing her town hall meeting, I was in the Bronx and in my district talking to constituents on West 231st Street. There was a celebration of a 50th anniversary of a delicatessen that has been thriving for 50 years, and I was giving the owner a proclamation, and we had people in the street just walking up and saying hello. I mean, we're all open. We're all vulnerable. It's a very, very difficult situation, but I don't think we can let this deter us, because it would have a detrimental effect on a democracy. So I kept my schedule for the past several days just as I had. I went to several events yesterday. I'm coming back to several events. My district is in Rockland. We had an event there this morning, and now I'm heading back to the Bronx for several events. We had a moment of silence as the president asked us to do at 11 o'clock for Gabby Giffords and for the other victims. And I was at an event talking about Haiti and the struggles of the people there. And I spoke before the minute of silence and talked about the plight of the people of Haiti and the struggles we have here in America. So, you know, I think it makes us all aware, but I don't think it's going to really deter us.
James Fallows, before we run out of time,
yep.
Do you want to ask anything of Congressman Engel?
I guess I would like to hear more about how you think your colleagues are responding to the appeal that many have made, that the importance of showing the ability to meet your constituents fearlessly. Do you think there's going to be how will that manifest itself in these next weeks?
Well, you know, I do in my district the same thing that Gabby Giffords was doing. I pick a supermarket or a shopping center, and I'm there to meet people on a walk-up basis, first come, first serve. We send notices to people who live in the surrounding area that your congressman, you know, Elliot Engel, will be there on such and such a time, and that's what Gabby Giffords was doing. So I am not going to change anything that I do, and I think that almost all of my, my colleagues would say the same thing. I think we have down the road, a further discussion, you know, with the FBI, with the Capitol Police, with the Sergeant at Arms. We had a conference call yesterday to discuss some of these things. And down the line, there's got to be a decision as to whether there should be heightened security for members of Congress. I mean, it costs money. We're in budget cutting mode. It's very difficult to do. But people have often asked me through the years when they see me come to an event by myself and with some staff people, you know, where's your security? And when I tell them I really don't have any, they're very many people are amazed at that. But I've never felt threatened. But these are difficult times. It wasn't too long ago when anybody in the public could walk onto an airplane and not worry about anything. Mm-hmm. Today we've got to go through X-ray machines of our bodies and our stuff we're carrying, and we're all used to it. So it may very well be that there'd have to be a change. After 9/11, we were recommended to get rid of our license plates that identified us as members of Congress. Most of us did that.
Congressman Elliot Engel, thanks a lot for calling in. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for doing this. Thank you very much.
And James Fallows from The Atlantic and National Journal. You can read his post on the Atlantic website called The Cloudy Logic of Political Shootings. James, thank you so much.
Brian, thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Still to come, State Assemblyman Hakeem Jeffries from Brooklyn. And then we'll talk about why this happened in Arizona, or perhaps at least was more likely to happen in Arizona than a lot of other places right now, with our It's a Free Country blogger Rodolfo de la Garza, who's originally from Tucson. And another reminder that we will have an online chat on how this changes our country at noon today on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. So a lot more to come. Stay with us.